Maybe I could begin things by telling a small joke. Can I tell an orthodox joke? An orthodox joke. So, two Protestant missionaries came to the Holy Land, and they came up to a monastery, and they banged on the door, and two monks came down, and the missionaries had a big Bible, and they said to the monks, "We've come to preach to you the original gospel of our Lord Jesus." And the monks look at each other, and they look at the missionaries, and they say, "Who is your bishop?" And the missionaries say, "We don't have a bishop." And the monks say, "When do you fast?" And they say, "We don't fast." And the monks say, "Where are your icons?" And they say, "We don't have any icons." So the first monk turns to the second one and says, "See, they're Turks." Only an Orthodox crowd, right? Yes, we're recording this, by the way, yes. This will be on the internet. There'll be a fatwa against me, I guess. I was asked to do a little bit more. I've used some names, historical names. I've mentioned them, maybe 30, 40 times. But I said, well, can you say just a little bit more about these historical figures that we've mentioned? And so I will say a little bit more. I do want to get into the canon law of marriage. But I do want to talk to... I've been asked to say, well, you've mentioned Theodore Balsam, and we know he's a patriarch of Antioch, but can you say a little bit more about him? And so I will say just a smidgen. One thing you should know is that he was a deacon of the great church of St. Sophia. Now, that's a very significant thing because as a deacon, there were various duties that deacons did at St. Sophia during the time that he served, and they preached. And so he went through all of these rungs or these duties of preaching. So he preached on the Old Testament, he preached on the Gospels, he preached on the Epistles, so it was all very structured. And in the course of doing this, he obtained an excellent theological knowledge. Those who were deacons in the Cathedral of St. Sophia, because they were so well trained by the various things they did, when some of them did become hierarchs, they were excellent sources for the church. You may know one of their names, the comments on the Gospels and Epistles, and we have his commentary, Theophylactos of Ohrid. Well, he is a product of this system. And so if I have to add something about Theodore Balsam, let me add this, that he was a man steeped in the Word of God, and just naturally so because of his duties. John Zonaras, if I could add something about him, we know something about him. He was a court official, but he became a monk, and he dedicated himself to the church. And his commentary on the canons of the church is regarded as astounding. It's regarded as one of the great triumphs of scholarship, of canonical scholarship. And has been estimated so by modern scholars. Alexios Aristinos, he again is another one that holds these offices of the great church, this very comprehensive theological education. And his commentary is kind of interesting because he's not commenting on the canons directly. He's commenting on a synopsis of the canons. So it's a synopsis. Ascribed. The synopsis is either that written by Simeon Metaphrastis or Simeon Logothetis. These are two figures. We're not sure which one wrote the synopsis. It's from the 10th century, and it's kind of an interesting approach. He's not commenting directly on the canon. So these are the three great commentators of the 12th century. Someone wanted to know a little bit more about them, and I think that's, I mean, I could go on a lot about them, but I think those are some things that we could keep in mind. I've been asked also about, to say something a little bit more about St. Nicodemus of the Holy Mountain. So his name is, to say just a little something more, so we usually associate him with the rudder. So the first thing people usually think of when they think of the rudder is St. Nicodemus of the Holy Mountain. However, he has a co-author, Agapius Leonados. He also is a monk of the Holy Mountain, the 18th century. He, according to contemporaries of the time, according to people who lived in the 18th century that knew these figures, knew St. Nicodemus and knew Agapius, and also modern scholars, they really don't, although Agapius Leonados was a canonist in his own right, in terms of the Pedalion, he is not regarded as really a co-author. He's not really, most people consider, most scholars and his contemporaries don't really consider him to be someone that had a really strong hand in constructing the Pedalion. And really his role is more of a political role in obtaining its endorsement by Patriarch Neophytos, the seventh of Constantinople. So in most editions of the rudder, you see this endorsement by the Patriarch at the beginning, Patriarch Neophytos, the seventh of Constantinople. The title of the work obviously refers to that icon, it's represented by that icon that I showed at the very beginning of my first introductory lecture. And it's the metaphor of the church as a ship and the canons as a guide, like a rudder for its direction. And that's the meaning of the word, that's what the word is referring to. St. Nicodemus's aim was to compile the original texts of the canons, translate them into modern Greek, and provide an interpretation based on Byzantine commentaries. It's interesting, though, that he relies upon a Western European collection of the canons for his text. It's the 1672 edition of an Anglican bishop by the name of William Beveridge. He also, and this is something that St. Nicodemus does, he's not afraid to use scholarship from the West. So he does, for example, if you look at the rudder, he uses the work of a German scholar, Johannes Leon Clavius, and he takes that work, which is on marriage legislation, and he incorporates it into the rudder. He uses Western scholarship, but he does not use it without a critical eye. He is making use of it, but he is not using it in such a way that it is something that is going to imperil his orthodoxy, so to speak. The English translation is currently out of print, but I have a digital version, and I'd be more than happy to make it available to whoever would like it. So it can be, the last time I saw it on eBay, it was going for about $400. This is a searchable PDF version. So it can be used as a reference. Someone came up to me and wanted to know a little bit more about Nikodim Milosh, and that's the last thing I'll speak to before we get into the definition of marriage. Nikodim Milosh was the bishop of Zara in Dalmatia. He would be considered by us as a Serbian. His systematic study of Orthodox canon law, and I was asked, well, what languages was it translated into? He did this systematic study called The Ecclesiastical Law of the Eastern Orthodox Church. It was published in 1890 in Serbian and then translated into German in 1897 and into Russian in the same year, Bulgarian in 1903, Greek in 1906, and then in Romanian. Unfortunately, no English, and no French. So the only Western European language is actually German. I think it's in five volumes in German. The Greek edition is very good. It's not only a translation, but there are many things that are added by the translator, a priest by the name of Meletios Apostolopoulos. He was a canonist, and he added a tremendous amount of material at the end of each chapter, just a gold mine of very rare material. And he was a Renaissance man. He was a chaplain in the Orthodox Church in Vienna. And he also, he translated a work that was done by a Catholic by the name of Joseph Zichmann on the marriage law of the Eastern Church. And this work, although done by someone that was not of our church, is excellent in that it's based on, and what makes it excellent? It's based on Byzantine sources and very scientifically done. And Apostolopoulos translates it, and again, he adds a tremendous amount of material to it, including material that we, contemporary to himself, that we would otherwise not have access to. So that's in response to a few requests that I had for some additional history, information about some of the figures I've been mentioning. So I'd like to now talk about marriage. Let's begin by one other thing. Father Michel brought up a point to me. In our discussion about Constantelos, Father Constantelos did a little synopsis of the canons of Trullo. There was, if you recall, he was talking about, you know, this canon says this and this canon says that. Those little synopses, I can't vouch for them being precise. They were his take on those things. And one of them, Trullo 27, he talks about assigned clothing. In no way take that to mean that the raso was being talked about in the 7th century. That would be very anachronistic. The canon is not concerned with, when, in fact, assigned clothing is probably not a good way of putting what the import of that canon was. It was probably more of prohibiting clergy from wearing inappropriate clothing, like silk and that kind of thing. But I really would suggest, fathers, to take a look at the list of canons, go to the actual canons. And if you have the opportunity, I'll make available the rudder to you, or you can buy the Nicene, Post-Nicene Fathers series text, or you can go up on the internet because they posted the Nicene, Post-Nicene Father volume that has the translation. It's a very poor translation, but nevertheless, it's what we've got to work with. And read the actual canons. So Constantelos was doing this just to give an impression. You really need to go to the source. And if you've got a question about it, I'd be more than happy to discuss it with you offline and you know, clear up any misapprehensions. But I do want to make that clear that Constantelos had a point to make. His main point was he was making a point about canons that were in disuse. And he said, why do this one if you don't do this one? That was his point. Let's concentrate on his main point and not the particular. Okay, so now, the definition of marriage. The definition of marriage contained in most Orthodox works of canon law is the following. This is, some of you may have heard of this and some of you may not, but this is our definition of marriage in canon law. It's marriage is a union of a man and woman, a consortium for an entire lifetime, a sharing of divine and human law. It has three parts, you know, union of a man and woman, consortium for an entire lifetime, and a sharing of divine and human law. This definition was formulated by Herennius Modestinus, a Roman legal expert or jurist of the 3rd century. And he was regarded as one of the last of the classical jurists. Was he a Christian? No. He was a pagan Roman jurist. The formula, however, is found in the legislative work of a Christian emperor, the Justinian the Great. He was the emperor from 527 to 565. It's found in these works, the Digest, the Code, and the Institutes. Those are major. That's the major legal work, the major legal instruments of the Roman Empire. Their works that were commissioned by a Christian emperor, and you may recall the position of the emperor within Byzantium. We talked about it yesterday, and often. Imperial legislation is an additional source of canonical legislation for the church, and certainly the church accepts this definition and adds something to it. It adds the words of how marriage is formed, and it says, through a blessing, crowning, or contract. And so what I propose to do is take each part of this formula and explain it a little bit. I'd also like to mention that it just doesn't appear in just the Code, the Institutes, and the Digest, but it continually appears in other civil works. It appears in the Imperial Code that was done in the 9th century, the Basilica. But again, it's taken by the church and used as the definition of marriage by the church. So the first part of this definition states that marriage is a union of a man and woman. And one of the characteristics of Orthodox marriage is an elaborate canonical framework of impediments that restrict marital unions. Many of these impediments, but not all, are shared in common with the Roman Catholic Church, but they are different. If you had to make a comparison, we would probably say they're more complex, more expansive in nature, particularly with regard to kinship. The main types of impediments are kinship, holy orders, and prior marriage. There are also certain particular circumstances involving the appearance of impropriety that prevent marriage as well. I was asked to expand on this section, so I'm going to do that. And in particular, I was asked to talk to kinship. So in terms of kinship, we have kinship by blood, consanguinity, and then we have what is called adoption. We have bilineal affinity in Greek, diegenia, or diegenia, trilineal affinity, triegenia, adoption by sponsorship from holy baptism, and adoption proper. So let me go over those. I'm going to depart from my presentation a bit and bring up some other slides, which are these right here. Okay, and there we go. And so, in discussing this, it's important to know that degrees, what we call in English, degrees are used in determining kinship relations. These are counted according to a complex formula following the orders of birth. We will go over that formula for you. Degrees are numbered for blood relations by the distance from the first principle of the lineage according to order of birth or rank. Examples of rank include siblings, parents, and grandparents. This is something that's very typical in used by canonists to show how we are related to various people in the bloodline. I kind of like to think of it like a pond. You throw a pebble into a pond and it kind of expands. In a certain way, we are related to a number of people in life by blood. And so we count orders of, we count our relationship or closeness or distance of relationship by numbering our closeness and distance of relationship. So when computing degree relationships for people related to us by blood, for us descendants or ascendants in the direct line, the general rule is this, and we're going to demonstrate it. Only the subject in question and the number of intervening people of different ranks are counted. And we're going to, I know that sounds a little complex, but we will show some examples. The first principle of the lineage, this is the general rule, the first principle of the lineage or the person to whom the subject's relationship is being determined is left out of the counting. So let's look at a few examples. This is where we would talk about two degrees of consanguinity. Let me get my little pointer out because that might be helpful. So the classic definition in Byzantine canon law for ascendants is that they are persons that have given birth to us. People that have given birth to us. These would be grandparents and parents, and then there's you, right? The classic definition for descendants is that they are persons that have been born from us. This diagram illustrates two degrees of kinship in the direct line. So you don't count you in order to find out your degree relation to your grandparents, so you're the subject. You don't count yourself, you count your parents one degree, your grandparents second degree. So you have a two-degree relationship of consanguinity, sharing the same blood, between you and your grandparents. If you go down the descendant line, and the Byzantines describe it as a ladder, so it's a ladder. Your children are related to you in one degree, and your grandchildren are related to you in 2 degrees. Okay, now, is that very clear? It's kind of simple, but that's how consanguinity works in the direct line, ascendants and descendants. Then you have what we call collateral relations, and these are defined as people that neither give birth to us nor were born from us, but are related, but who are related by one and the same origin and derivation, right? So they also share blood, but they are not people that give birth to us. How do these work? We have, as In the case of collateral relations, as shown in this diagram, the number of persons of different rank are counted between the two subjects inclusive, but not their common ancestor. And thus, as illustrated in this diagram, you have sisters and brothers are members of the same order of birth and computed to be, let's take this. Sisters and brothers, how would that be computed? Here's you, 1 degree. You don't count the common origin, and then you go to the second degree for your brothers and sisters. So you're related collaterally by the second degree to your brother or sister. If you want to find out how you're related to your aunts and uncles, your collateral relations, you would count one, two, not the common origin, so you don't count the common origin, and you go to three. So it's one, two, three. Everybody got that? All right. So that's how you do consanguinity. I mean, that's how you do collateral relations. It's you are sharing blood. Now, the general rule, this is pretty standard stuff, ascendants are impeded infinitely from marrying descendants. So you would never marry your grandparent, right? You would never marry your children, right? Yeah, that's kind of... however, collaterally, and it differs among the local churches, but we can say that by the eighth degree, it permits marriage for collateral relations. That would be the sharing the common origin, but not in the direct line. So the seventh... The seventh degree, well, this is a general rule, the seventh degree impedes this absolutely, but this differs from local church to local church, I have to tell you. It kind of varies between the sixth, seventh, and eighth, but you can be assured anything below the sixth is absolutely impeded. Everybody with me so far?
Yes, but
because this was a special request, I'm going to put a case study up on the slides that is from the book, and we're going to go and look at it together that will actually deal with that. And then what I want to do is go over what the clergy guide, the 2011 clergy guide, says that you should be doing, because that's the general rule that you're following in terms of collateral, and also, and we're just about to get into the meaning of these words trienya and dienya. Okay, we want to find out what that means, because that's kind of important, because we're talking about relationship by marriage here. We've talked about ascendants, descendants. We've talked about collateral relations. Now we want to talk about degree of kinship. This is all kinship now. It's calculated for relations by affinity. What we say affinity, we mean marriage. Marriage. Your relations by marriage. Now we've stated there are two different types of affinity that are distinguished. The first is kinship. The first one is established by one marriage between two lineages, and I'll show you an example of that. That's called bilineal affinity. That's dienya. And the other is trilineal affinity. The word, just to kind of decipher this for you, tri means what? Three? Okay. Lineal means lines. You know, lines, one, two, three. So they're like three families, right? Related by two marriages. So trilineal affinity, three lines related by two marriages. Dilineal, two lines, two families related by one marriage. Kind of decipher it for you? The Greek terms that are used in Byzantine canon law are trienia and di yenya. I think it's good to use the, you know, our language. I mean, it is our language. It is in Greek, but it's a concept, and I'm trying to. Anyway, let's look at an example. So this is di yenya. Okay, so we have two lineages. Okay, what does this example show? All right, the sphere. This is taken right out of. By the way, these examples are taken right out of Milosz. This is taken out of that Nicodim Milosz, the bishop of Zara in Dalmatia. He uses this. These are his examples. So, and he uses these very shapes to illustrate these points. So this is very classical in terms of the way I'm showing it to you. So you got the husband is this is a husband. This is a male. This is a female, right? This example shows two lineages, right? You've got the husband's family, and he's married to this wife. So the husband is B, the wife is C, she has parents, they're A, and she has a brother, right? And this is his, what would he be then? He would be his brother-in-law, right? Okay, so D is the brother-in-law. So what you have here is one marriage establishing bilineal affinity, or otherwise known as di yenya, okay? Now, what does tri yenya look like? Now you have, in this example, you have two marriages. B and C is one marriage. See that? One marriage. And D and E is another marriage. And you have three families involved. One family here, one family here, and one family here, right? So two marriages and three lines. Everybody got it? All right. So when you're trying to calculate degrees of kinship, how does that work? Okay, here's how the rules are. We want to do it for two sister-in-laws, okay? So you've got for triyenya, right? You've got two marriages, three families involved. This is the husband of C. B and C are married, and this is who? This is his sister, okay? You got the same deal going on here, except this is the wife, and this is her sister, right? So you want to find out what is the degree of relationship, and we use degrees to calculate how closely they're related, right? The lower the number, the more closely related they are. So when degrees of kinship are sought between blood relations from each spouse's side, the husband and wife are each assigned one degree. So this is one degree, this is one degree, right? So by means of computation, in order to discover the relationship between the two sisters-in-law, the married couple and the first sister are assigned each one degree. So this is one degree here. This marriage is assigned one degree, right? Got it so far? Making a total of two. That's the way it's calculated. So you count the sister by herself as one, and the marriage here as two. Likewise, the married couple over here is assigned another degree. You don't count the parents. So they're assigned a degree right here, this marriage. And then this sister is assigned her own degree. And so when you add it up to find out the degree of relationship, the closeness of relationship by affinity, by marriage, between these two sister-in-laws is going to be 4 degrees. Everybody got that? Okay. I know you have to map it out a bit, but this is the way it works. So, what is the general rule? The general rule in cases of dienya, marriages, and this is a generality based on common usages of the autocephalous churches in Orthodoxy, marriages are generally permitted between relatives whose relationship is beyond the sixth degree. For cases of triyenya, marriages are generally permitted beyond the third degree. So that's the general rule there. Then we have relationship by baptism. Spiritual relationship as an impediment. And again, it's a form of what? Adoption. It's considered a form of kinship by adoption, as affinity is. Trullo 53 sponsors the following, establishes the following. These are the following relationships that are impeded for marriage. The sponsor with the baptized person, the sponsor and the mother of the baptized person, the son of the sponsor and the baptized person, the sponsor and the daughter of the baptized person, the son of the sponsor and the daughter of the baptized person. So those are, that's pretty standard. In general, marriages are permitted beyond the third degree, but again, this varies according to local and autocephalous church. So let's examine this a little bit more carefully and see how degrees of relationship for holy baptism are calculated. The first degree of relationship from holy baptism is the sponsor to the baptized person, the reverse, is viewed as having the same degree relationship as a natural parent. The second degree of relationship from holy baptism, these are considered to be included among those. You have the sponsor to the father or mother of the baptized person, the spiritual natural fathers of the baptized person are reckoned not only as co-parents, but also as brothers and sisters to one another. The children of the sponsor and the baptized, they are viewed as spiritual brothers and sisters to each other. And in addition, I might add, baptized persons sponsored by the same sponsor sometimes are viewed as having the same relationship as in the case of natural children from the same parent, but that's kind of disputed, actually. That is disputed. This is the third degree of relationship from holy baptism. In this example, let's consider how the degrees are calculated. Let's consider the sponsor with the brothers and sisters of the baptized person. So the sponsorship of the baptized person is assigned 1 degree. The birth of the baptized person from his or her parents is considered 1 degree, and the birth of the brother and sister are assigned 1 degree. You add them all up, and it's a third degree relationship. I know it's a bit complicated. This is probably the most complicated bit about the calculation, but I will make these slides available to you for your reference if you'd like. I'll write up a small summary in notes. Actually, if you have the book actually has, in the appendix, the book actually has all of this mapped out. So you can actually refer to it. If you've got the book, you don't need to wait for my notes. It's in one of the appendices. I will get to that point in just a second, because you want to know whether you follow this here in the Antiochian Archdiocese. And I will show you what the clergy guide says, okay? But we always ask our hierarch what is proper. Not me, Sayedna, but I will show the clergy guide, and then Sayedna makes the determinations. So the fourth degree of relationship from holy baptism, in this example, we have the natural children of the sponsor with the brothers or sisters of the baptized person. So again, the sponsorship of the baptized person, always assigned one degree. The birth of the children from the sponsor, one degree. The birth of the baptized person from his or her own parents, one degree. The birth of the brothers or sisters of the sponsored, one degree, all adding up into 4 degrees. The final thing that I wanted to say about this subject is that we also have adoption proper, and in the Byzantine tradition, the same impediments are established as if the relationship was by consanguinity or blood. So if someone is adopted as a son, they are treated as if they were a natural son. So there is some variety here, but mostly it's this. Let me now go to how the clergy guide reads. As I said, all Orthodox churches prohibit marriage between ascendants and descendants in the direct line. This is, you don't marry your grandparents or your children. It's immoral. This is what the clergy guide says. It says a dispensation is necessary for collateral relations in the 5th and 6th degrees. That means you need a dispensation to do anything below the 7th, which is what I said was pretty standard. So below the 7th, you would need a dispensation to go. This is what the clergy guide says. And 6 degrees, one note of explanation here is that first cousins are in the 4th degree. For the 3rd and 4th degrees, only in extreme necessity. Now, from my experience, this is nothing. The dispensations have been given in Orthodox churches on these points. But generally, the 7th degree, 7th and 8th are pretty standard throughout the Orthodox world. The Antiochians have the most rigorous practice with regard to baptism in the clergy guide. Adoption by spiritual relationship for holy baptism up to the 4th degree. And then the example is given, the 3rd degree forbids marriage between the sponsor and the brothers and sisters of the baptized person. So that's in the clergy guide. And it's a very practical thing. I have a case study that addresses this point. Should we do the case study now? Because it explains why we do this. Okay, all right. We're looking at 3 texts. They're drawn from who? Matthew Philostorus, who authors what? He authors a canon law encyclopedia, 14th century. Before you came here, did you know how many here knew the name Matthew Philostorus? All right, so you've learned something, right? Okay. I've spoken to what happened in the late Byzantine time. Did they produce a lot of matrimonial legislation? Yes. And so we're going to look at some of it. And it's in effect in the Orthodox Church today. We have this synodal decision that takes place under Luke Chrysovergis, a patriarch of Constantinople, and it's still regarded as valid. Then we have the Tomos of Sicinius, which is a synodal degree decree concerning marital impediments, and that's issued in the 10th century. And then we have Canon 53 of Trullo. Okay, going to your point, Father. Okay, so this illustrates blood relations, okay? The question is coming up, can I marry my second cousin in the sixth degree, right? Sixth degree by blood, not an in-law. And okay, so this text kind of holds the key to the theological or the theological reason for why we have impediments. And so if we read it, and I'll kind of do a public reading if it's all right. All right, and this thing gave up the ghost. Because some celebrated such marriages secretly because of the heaviness of punishments, matters concerning this were referred to the synod when Luke the Divine ruled the patriarchal throne. What throne is that? Constantinople, right? Consequently, the Holy Synod determined and ordered that such a marriage not be attempted or established at all. One requested to be forbidden, one attempted to be broken up, they who contracted it to be excommunicated, and the priest who married them, if he did it this secretly, not on account of ignorance, to be defrocked. A decree of the celebrated Emperor Manuel Porfiriginatos, is the emperor interfering? No, he's not, right? Good government, he's the administrator of the empire. Confirmed this synodal act. In this way, one is not permitted to marry the daughter of his second cousin, who happens to be his niece. It's an important thing there, niece, okay? And thus the law bridled marriage with what is by nature righteous, decent, and honorable. So what is the reason for this impediment? The reason being given is forbidding a marriage based on what is by nature righteous, decent, and honorable. To put it another way, is it moral to sexually desire and marry this relation who is known, has a family name, you know? They're being referred to as what? A niece, right? A niece. That's a family relationship. You could say sister, too, but in this case, niece. Is it moral to sexually desire and marry one's own niece, or is it unrighteous, perverse, and dishonorable? I think that's what is meant by saying righteous, decent, and honorable. What's the opposite? Unrighteous, perverse, and dishonorable. So the reason given is related to what? The family relationship. The name here, this person is known as a niece. That is the relationship. So is it, this is the theological reason. This is the why. You calculate kinship because you're dealing with what? And it's based on what? Family role and family name, nieces and nephews, even if they're once removed. In this case, we have an uncle once removed, grandfather, great uncle, uncle and aunt once removed, second cousin. And so what we're dealing here is with a family relationship. Does that make it clear? So that's what we're talking about.
What is once removed? I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Family math has never been my strong
suit. Yeah. So I could map it out a bit. Let me just summarize it. We're talking about cousins here.
Yes.
We're talking about cousins, and so the various cousins have various titles. And once removed is a way of referring to a certain cousin relationship. And what we're talking about here, the key here is, though, the key here is the term niece. We're referring to a cousin in a niece relationship. I know it's a little bit, and this is where the latitude comes in granting it, where someone might consider doing a dispensation, because the some of these relationships that are so extended that had this cultural understanding of niece and nephew, or even mother and father, we no longer have this understanding because we don't live together in these relationships any longer. And so there is this element to it, and that's where the latitude comes in terms of kinship relations. You remember that big chart I had at the very beginning? It gets very complex. Once removed is involved in that big chart. Okay. I hope that suffices. But the key to understanding, and the reason why this is relevant to us today, because it's not just dusty stuff in books that's overcomplicated and nasty to figure out. The reason why it's so relevant is because people don't stay married today. They get divorced, they get divorced frequently. And then they have blended families. And their children then are related to one another in a blended family. And adoption, it's regarded as almost like a form of adoption. You have this now blended family. And the reason why this is so relevant is because we are dealing with, and this is why this is has an eternal significance for us, it is based on family role. It is based on family role. So is this person my brother? Is this person now my cousin? Is this person now my niece in a blended family? And if we think of it within a moral context, we are thinking about who can marry who morally and ethically to maintain a family relationship. Let's take another example. And this makes it a little bit more clearer. This is the Thomas of Sicinius. 10th century. The law states the mother, and notice it's the law, it's taken from the civil law. Is that a bad thing? No. It's civil law becomes a canonical source. The mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother of my wife are mothers-in-laws, and I marry none of them. Now we're talking about what? Affinity is what? Your relationship to them by marriage, right? Okay. Notice that's a very important statement. The mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother of my wife are, and they grouped all together in one term, mothers-in-law. And I marry none of them. You know, why would that be so important? You know, we think of it as these very old people. Was life expectancy so long in ancient times? Probably not. So this could be a very real possibility. But that's the family relationship, mothers-in-law. The wives of my son and grandson and the spouse of my great-grandson are called what? Daughters-in-law. The daughter from another man of my wife, as well as the granddaughter and great-granddaughter of another man, are called what? Stepdaughters. I marry none of those. See how it goes? Nor my stepmother, even if my father had many, since they have the rank of mothers. Nor may a stepmother marry the former husband of my stepdaughter. Nor may I marry the daughter of the woman separated from me, who after separation was born from another man. It's not comedy. It's family relationship. They're all mother-in-laws. They're all stepdaughters. That's the family relationship. The Thomas of Sicinius, this is Matthew of Lestaris now commenting. The Thomas of Sicinius forbade two brothers to marry an aunt and niece and vice versa. Two brothers were also forbidden to marry two first cousins. The fifth degree is observed in the first case, the sixth degree in the second case. Therefore, up to the fifth degree, all have been forbidden on account of affinity, if it might be necessary to count degrees for these. If those of the sixth degree do not have confusion, now this is the key here. If those of the sixth degree do not have confusion regarding the names of lineage, they are not impeded. However, if a confusion of names is apparent, they are forbidden. When it says a confusion of names, what are they referring to? Names. Family relationship. Are they mothers to me? Are they stepdaughters to me? Are they nieces to me? And what it goes back to that principle. What is moral, decent, and righteous? You don't want to do what is immoral, perverse, and unrighteous. A classic formula. It deals with ethics. It deals with who you desire sexually. Now let's go to the kinship from, is that clear? Okay, let's go to kinship from baptism. This is the summary of, in the Canon Law Encyclopedia from the 14th century. Canon 53 of the Sixth Council states, because spiritual kinship is superior to bodily union, we decree that children who were received from holy and salvific baptism, and after this who were joined in marriage to their widowed spiritual mothers, desist from cohabitation and thereafter be subject to the penalties of fornication. And what would that be? What's the first principle here? It's a family relationship. We decree children who were received from holy civic baptism, and after this, who were joined in marriage with their widowed spiritual mothers. So it's the wife of what? These are their godparents, right? Marrying one's godparent. That would be regarded as what? Marrying a mother, right? Because that's the principle. Spiritual kinship is superior to bodily union. And it's regarded as what? Incestuous. Thus, he that does not readily depart from evil and does not confess is condemned as incestuous. Now, here's the point, and it says here, and it's taken from the law. Nevertheless, he that receives a female godchild from holy baptism cannot afterwards take her in marriage, since she now becomes his daughter. See the relationship? Daughter. Nor may he marry his godchild's mother or daughter, because they're now part of his family. There's a family relationship. This also applies to the sponsor's son. If we're regarding now they're all related together, even more closely than through blood, you know, this is the same, but think of it as the same as blood. Because nothing, and this is the key, because nothing else can introduce a paternal state, an impediment of marriage. In other words, generate a family relation, paternal state, generate a family relationship like this bond by which God mediates the joining of their souls. So that's the theological reason is that God establishes a union of souls during baptism between the sponsor and the baptized. This results in a parent-godparent relationship between the sponsor and the spiritual child, and the spiritual union is viewed as affecting the relationship of other members of the family. Now, should The question that we want to ask is, should these impediments of relationship by blood, affinity, and spiritual relationship from holy baptism be applied today? The question, I think the answer is yes, of course they should be. And as the practitioners of, you are, as this is canon law's ministry. You're protecting the sacredness of the family. You're protecting the sacredness of the moral relationship between family members. You're preserving the family, and you're preserving the holiness of marriage by becoming familiar with what is established in terms of family relationship, how it's established, either by blood, by marriage, or by spiritual relationship. And there is a standard set for you in the clergy guide, the 2011 clergy guide, about the nearness of relationship and how it may impede a marriage based on moral reasons, ethical reasons, based on spiritual reasons. Anyway, this was by special request. Yes. So did that answer your question about the clergy guide? Yeah, it did, because I showed you what the clergy guide said. And I did show you why, according to the Byzantine text. So,
I have another question.
Yeah, you have another one. Okay.
What? Can be godparents for the same person? One couple.
A married couple.
Well, technically speaking, it's who receives, my understanding, who receives, one person receives from the font, right?
One.
Okay. It's one person. There's your answer.
You say that the second sponsor is not a necessity.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing. Did you notice if the sponsor dies, let's say the sponsor is the husband, and he dies, does the relationship still exist? Yes. Yes, right. Can she marry is it still forbidden for her to marry the godchild? Yeah, of course. Just because the sponsor died does not end the family relationship.
If it is possible that we have more, because a lot of us have churches where we have a lot of people, and we have a lot of people in the parish who become godparents to some of the children in the parish, so I have to give a warning to them. You have to be careful who you select as your sponsors for the child's baptism, because
yes,
it will make it impossible for certain children.
Absolutely.
If there were the simplest chart possible that we could use to pass out to our people. So it's not just us trying to explain it, because I think we're having a hard time myself.
Okay, so I would be glad to undertake that project. I would, can I do that to Sayedna? All right. I will undertake the project of charting it out. It's been done before. Nikodim Milosh, it's been done before. I can simply use his chart. But I did include, because of my teaching at the Antiochian village, I did include an appendix in this book that lists in words this, but there's nothing like a chart.